Good evening. The first trial, the first person charged with defying a subpoena to appear before the House January 6th committee is now fully underway. We're not just talking about any person. This is Steve Bannon, one-time Time magazine cover boy who was in, then out of the former president's administration in good graces, and whose name has come up again and again in the January 6th committee hearings. In opening statements today, federal prosecutors argue that the now right-wing podcaster put himself above the law. The defense suggesting the two contempt of Congress charges against him were politically motivated. Proceedings began today after the judge in the case, Carl Nichols, who's a Trump appointee, denied a defense request for a month-long delay. You'll recall that last week he rejected a number of defenses, including Bannon's claim of executive privilege, leading one Bannon defense attorney to ask, and these are his words, quote, "What's the point of going to trial if there are no defenses?" To which the judge replied, "Agreed." Now, remember, this is the same Steve Bannon who promised, as he made his first court appearance, to make this, quote, the misdemeanor from hell. Hey, it's the same Steve Bannon who, even as he recently offered to appear live before the Select Committee, expressed contempt for its members and continued his tough guy routine, trying to set conditions for his testimony.
Here's what I need. Give me a date, a time, a room number, a microphone, and a holy Bible that I can take the oath on. Boom, deliver that, and we'll see how good you are, little Jamie Raskin and Liz Cheney and all of it. Serve it up.
I'm surprised he isn't speaking about himself in the third person. Generally, when people view themselves as really important, they reach peak pomposity, and then they generally tend to do that. Now, for most people, getting a subpoena to appear, whether before Congress or in court, means just that. You appear. There's no option to negotiate terms, of course. That hasn't stopped members of the former administration from trying. There's certainly no option to simply say no, as Bannon has, and it's understandable why a committee focused on January 6th and what led up to it might want to hear from Steve Bannon. He was, after all, a leading cheerleader and, by his own claims, a leading voice in it all.
Live from our nation's capital, you're in the field headquarters of one of the small divisions of the bloodless coup. Step by step by step, day by day, understanding we're all going to converge on that point on the 6th.
He said a lot of things like that. More specifically, though, the committee is interested in his calls with the former president and what he said after one of them.
The committee has learned from the White House phone logs that the president spoke to Steve Bannon, his close advisor, at least twice on January 5th. The first conversation they had lasted for 11 minutes. Listen to what Mr. Bannon said that day after the first call he had with the president.
All hell is going to break loose tomorrow. It's all converging, and now we're on, as they say, the point of attack, right? The point of attack tomorrow. I'll tell you this. It's not going to happen like you think it's going to happen, okay? It's going to be quite extraordinarily different. And all I can say is strap in.
From those same phone logs, we know that the president and Mr. Bannon spoke again on the phone that evening, this time for 6 minutes.
Now, Judge Nichols, again a Trump appointee, has ruled out executive privilege and a number of other potential defense arguments, leading Steve Bannon with not many options and no way to make good on this threat.
Pray for our enemies, okay? Pray for, because we're going medieval on these people. We're going to savage our enemies. So pray for them. That's who needs prayers? Not MAGA. Not War Room, and certainly not Stephen K. Bannon.
And I spoke too soon. He is actually now speaking about himself in the third person. And I must say, sounding kind of like I did when I was 11 years old and playing Dungeons & Dragons. CNN's Caitlin Pollance was in the D.C. federal courtroom today and was outside when, as we mentioned moments ago, Steve Bannon spoke out. What was it like inside the courtroom today?
Well, Anderson, when we arrived this morning, we really thought that it was going to be very smooth. This case would get off, off very quickly. The jury would be seated and we'd be off to the races with opening statements. That is not what happened at all. And I actually want to highlight a little bit what Steve Bannon said outside the court, because it echoed some of the strategy that his lawyers were trying inside the court. Here he is after court ended today.
Benny Thompson sent a staffer over here. Where is Benny Thompson? We subpoenaed Thompson, and they're hiding behind these phony privileges. He's too gutless to come over here himself. He's made it a crime. Not a civil charge of wanting my testimony, but a crime. And he didn't have the courage or guts to show up here, and he sent a staffer. I challenge Benny Thompson today to have the courage to come to this courthouse. If he's going to charge somebody with a crime, he's going to be man enough to show up here.
So he's calling for House Select Committee Chair Benny Thompson to come down the street to testify in court. That sounds like political bluster, but that's actually something that his attorneys have tried to argue in this case. They've wanted to subpoena members of Congress, members of the committee, Thompson himself. The judge has said, no, that's not going to happen at this time, maybe in a very sliver of a chance later on. But right now, that wasn't going to happen. And that was really reflective of the approach in court of his attorneys today. They kept trying to wedge things back into this case that the judge had already said it's not going to happen. And really, that's what consumed most of the morning. I said we thought that it was going to go smoothly. We ended up not starting with a jury sworn in until about 1 o'clock. And that's because his attorneys kept asking for things. They kept raising things like that they wanted to delay the trial again. They asked for a month delay, maybe delay it to on Friday or on Monday. The judge said no. They're also not going to be able to bring executive privilege, what Donald Trump was telling him, what his attorneys were telling him, into this case as we know it right now.
And what's the core of the case the government has put together against him?
Well, the government's case is simple, it's straightforward, it's efficient. That's how they have been approaching it from the beginning. And that's really what we saw from them today in their opening statements. They framed it as this isn't just a contempt of Congress case. Steve Bannon has contempt for Congress. And they really tried to simplify this down for the jury, not get into the privilege ideas, which they really can't. And they really, really wanted to show that Bannon had a firm date where he needed to turn over documents and where he needed to show up for testimony. And he defied that willingly. That is what they have been trying to show. And one of their witnesses, we saw the first witness today, Kristen Amerling. She's a deputy with the House Select Committee. The questions were very straightforward for her. Did he turn over documents on that date he needed to, October 7th? She said he did not. And then she was asked, did he show up for testimony at 10 a.m. on October 14th, the date his subpoena said he should? And her answer was she did not.
Galen Polian, thanks. Appreciate it. Joining us now, CNN senior investigative correspondent Drew Griffin, whose special report on Steve Bannon, Divided We Fall, aired over the weekend. Also CNN contributor and former Watergate star witness John Dean, who served as White House counsel in the Nixon administration. And CNN senior political correspondent Abby Phillip, anchor of CNN Inside Politics Sunday. What do you make of Bannon's defense here, John? What is of his argument?
It's a very weak defense. He's really trying to say this is a witch hunt and everything is political. Well, of course it's political. It's a political body that took this action against his contempt. But it's not a winning argument because the government's just going to shred it and say, of course, they're political and they're doing what they're charged to do by the House. And he's defying it. So it's a pretty simple case.
Abby, we saw, you know, Bannon leave the court, as Abby was talking about, and try to get into some sort of like mano-a-mano challenge with Select Committee Chairman Benny Thompson, chiding him for not showing up. Benny Thompson actually, I mean, has an important job. Steve Bannon is a podcaster accused of breaking the law. And the staffer who apparently was on the witness stand, I assume that's the staffer who was sent, was basically just asked basic questions. Did he provide documents? Did he show up?
Yeah, I mean, as Caitlin said, the government's case is pretty straightforward. Steve Bannon was served a subpoena. He didn't answer it, didn't even attempt to answer it, and showed contempt for the process, for the institution of Congress. And that, as far as Steve Bannon's concerned, is the point. I mean, Bannon, it has always been about really undermining institutions like Congress, defying them flagrantly in an effort to make the point that they are, in his mind, illegitimate. And so it doesn't surprise me that these proceedings have gone along these lines with Bannon continuing to put on a show for his podcast audience. That is ultimately what this is about. He really does have an audience of one at the end of the day, and that is still Donald Trump. I still think that in a lot of ways, Bannon is acting in a way that he believes Trump would be pleased with. And in fact, from the evidence that we have, Trump is pleased with how Bannon has been defying Congress up until this point.
Drew, as we mentioned, you did this fascinating CNN report about Bannon, the special report. And I want to play just one particularly relevant part of that for our viewers.
Outside a recent hearing in his case, CNN caught up to Steve Bannon.
Why do you continue to push the lie that the 2020 election was stolen?
It's not a lie.
It's a lie. You have no proofs. We've looked at all the facts.
You haven't. I tell you
You don't have the facts. Rudy doesn't have the facts.
Hey, do me a favor. get this guy. I want to sit down with you this week for 2 hours. We're going to go through all the evidence.
Okay, how about okay? Friday?
Friday, done.
All right.
Done deal.
Despite that pledge, the interview never happened. Bannon ultimately ignored all our requests for interviews.
I should mention that Bannon's defense team used the airing of your documentary as an argument to delay his trial. That argument failed.
Yeah, it like all his other motions and last-minute appeals to try to stop this trial failed. Funny, he was promoting our documentary on his own show at the same time his attorneys were telling a judge because of the pretrial publicity they should delay it. But I feel for Congress. We were trying to get an interview with Steve Bannon for many, many months. He dragged us along, or his people dragged us along. And then, as you saw there, even after he promised to sit down and talk to us all about how the election was, in fact, stolen, he just blew us off, basically, because he can't defend that, Anderson. He's just looking for a show, like Abby said. He can't reasonably defend any of his positions. And, you know, the odds are that if he did answer his subpoena and walk into Congress, he wouldn't have been talking to Benny Thompson anyway. He'd been talking to investigators who would be asking him about facts, not bluster.
And I mean, John, the Justice Department, you know, their argument is that the subpoena was mandatory, not optional. But as we have seen, there's a long list of people, Mark Meadows and others, who have just ignored these subpoenas. I mean, Mark Meadows sort of gave some information to the committee, Dan Scavino. Does it hurt the DOJ's case at all against Bannon that others?
I don't think that's even relevant. I don't think it'll even get into the case. Bannon might try to get it in, but it's not going to happen. He committed his crime, and that's what will be the focus.
Is that cut and dried?
It's cut and dried, absolutely. And we can see it. This is a cut and dried judge. He's having no play with this nonsense that's going on.
And Abby, Bannon told the January 6th committee that he's now willing to testify, preferably at a public hearing. That's not going to happen. Is there any more clarity on how the committee is ultimately going to handle Steve Bannon?
Yeah, more than likely the committee, they've said, Congresswoman Elaine Loria, one of the members of the committee, told CNN that they still want to talk to him. They will probably have an interview with him in a closed-door setting, which they have done with all of their witnesses, a closed-door setting first, and then possibly a public setting. But I don't think Bannon is going to be in the category of people that they are going to have in a public setting. Bannon would make a mockery of that process, and I think that they are very much aware of that. What they want to do is just get him on the record. You know, I do think there are some questions about whether Bannon even really respects this idea that when you swear under oath that you're not going to lie to Congress, that that means that you don't lie to Congress. We'll see how that would turn out in a private interview, but ultimately, that's what the January 6th committee wants. They want him under oath, on the record, probably with the lawyers and not even with the committee members, just to get on the record whether he's pleading the fifth or his side of the story as far as they're concerned.
You know, Drew, the sort of various iterations of Steve Bannon, it's sort of fascinating, and your documentary, you know, kind of showed this. You know, on the cover of Time magazine, you know, carried himself as the person who helped Trump win the presidency, you know, as a co-campaign manager, then fell out of favor with the White House, banished from the White House. Trump was bad-mouthing him. Now Trump seems to like him again, and he's gained power politically within the Trump movement, Trumpism, for pushing the election law.
Yeah. In our report, we looked at Steve Bannon and Steve Bannon's long game. And it was a long game that began before Donald Trump. And I think that's what is the real danger here that we might be missing in some of this. Steve Bannon has started a political movement based on a lie. We may all believe in our hearts that no one could possibly follow him. He is very adept at motivating people who believe in that lie and believe that they are somehow aggrieved by this election loss to action. And he's getting people to run for offices who are election deniers. And he's setting up a scene where in 2024, we may actually have election deniers who are overseeing the vote. And that is the real danger that we found in our documentary. And he's doing it all on this podcast, which has millions and millions of followers
who basically live within the echo chamber that he's developed. And I don't think you can overlook that in terms of his political power. It's not just about Trump. It's about his view of what the United States and the world should be. And I think many people would be frightened of that.
Interesting. Drew Griffin, John Dean, Abby Phillip, thank you. A major development as well in Georgia's investigation of attempts to overturn election results there. And a big shift, prosecutors say, that all 16 so-called fake electors who were part of the former president's scheme and who signed an unofficial electoral certificate that was sent to the National Archives are now targets of a criminal probe. They've all gotten what are known as target letters. CNN's Nick Valencia joins us now with the latest. So what more have you learned?
Hey there, Anderson. Yeah, this is major. So significant because it shows that District Attorney Fani Willis here could be inching towards potential criminal charges in her probe as she looks for potential election interference here in the state of Georgia. Up until now, we know that these 16 electors had been participating and cooperating with Willis. But this is the first time that we're hearing that these 16 electors could face potential criminal charges. According to one of the attorneys, for many of these electors, some of them had been cooperating with Willis as witnesses, but not as targets. And all that changed, according to court filings, in late June when attorneys for Willis's office say that new evidence came to light. Now, attorneys for the electors are pushing back on this claim. They're saying that this is all a publicity stunt and that the electors agreed to be witnesses for Willis's investigation, but it was not in good faith. But why this is so significant is, it shows that Willis is potentially inching closer towards these criminal charges. And it also shows, Anderson, just how wide-reaching and the broad scope of her investigation as well. Anderson?
Is there any indication this investigation is drawing closer to the former president?
There is, and it does suggest that this may be drawing closer to former President Trump. And we should remind our viewers, it was earlier this month that seven key Trump allies were given subpoenas. And that includes the former president's attorney, Rudy Giuliani, as well as South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, as well as five legal advisors to the Trump campaign. Anderson, one thing is clear, we're going to see a lot of legal wrangling before there's any resolution to this all. Anderson?
And Valencia, appreciate it. Next, those Secret Service text messages the Select Committee wants from January 5th and 6th, and why they don't have them yet, and what happens if they were deleted, despite two warnings from Congress not to do that. Later, big parts of Europe, not just baking in record high temperatures, but burning up as well. We'll show you where the worst of the heat and fires are and why this could be a sign of things to come ahead. One of the hottest topics of the January 6th hearings is the role of the Secret Service, whether involving the former president's alleged anger when told he could not go to the Capitol, or former vice president's concern that his detail might whisk him away from the Capitol, keeping him from doing his duty. Now, the Select Committee, as you know, subpoenaed the Secret Service for any pertinent documents, calls, and text messages. Today, the agency delivered a first installment, but crucially, minus any text. CNN's Ryan Noble's at the Capitol for us tonight. At this point, Ryan, is there any chance that the text messages in question can be recovered?
There is a question, Anderson, but no one seems to have the answer to it. The Secret Service can't seem to say with specificity whether or not they think these messages can be recovered. They're also even suggesting maybe these messages never existed, that their agency actually never used text messages to communicate during that crucial period of time. The January 6th Select Committee keeps asking over and over again for specific information about where these texts are and if they can ever be retrieved. I talked to Jamie Raskin earlier today, a member of the committee, and he said they just aren't getting those answers yet, but they promised that they were going to push forward and not quit asking those questions until they get the answers. And then if they don't get the answers they're looking for, they'll try and figure out what to do next.
I mean, it's really an extraordinary situation. The idea that they, on such an important event, that there would be missing text messages, and then just the lack of clarity still continuing.
Yeah, and I think that's an important part of this, Anderson, is that part of what the January 6th Select Committee wants to know is how these agents communicated with each other during this crucial period of time. So if it wasn't through text messages, was it through some other form of communication? And that's part of the reason that they issued this subpoena, asking for a wide range of records so that they can sift through all of it and see if they can get the answers that they're looking for. But there's no doubt that the Secret Service has been evasive in their answering of some of these questions. It's one of the reasons that the Inspector General was so frustrated by his look into this information. And it's one of the reasons that the committee continues to press the Secret Service for answers.
And they're not the only ones investigating these text messages.
Yeah, that's right. Now the National Archives is involved. They sent a letter today to the Department of Homeland Security, which is the agency that oversees the Secret Service, asking them to look into this lack of text messages being available between the days of January 5th and January 6th. And the National Archives has a very specific request. They've given the Secret Service and the Department of Homeland Security 30 days to come up with an explanation for where these text messages went. Secret Service has said that they are ready to comply. But Anderson, there's a lot of weight behind this request by the National Archives. It is against the law to delete or destroy federal records. The National Archives could ultimately refer this information to the Department of Justice if they aren't satisfied with the answers that they're given by the Department of Homeland Security or Secret Service.
Mm. Ryan Nobles, appreciate it. And as Ryan just mentioned, the National Archives putting the Department of Homeland Security, which oversees the Secret Service, as he said, on notice. Chief Records Officer Lawrence Brewer sending the department a letter asking for an explanation should the messages turn out to have been improperly deleted. I'm quoting now from it. This report must include a complete description of the records affected, a statement of the exact circumstances surrounding the deletion of messages, a statement of the safeguards established to prevent further loss of documentation, and details of all agency actions taken to salvage, retrieve, or reconstruct the records. The proverbial strongly worded letter, perspective now from former Kansas Governor John Carlin, who served as archivist at the National Archives and Records Administration from 1995 to 2005. Governor Carlin, do you think the request from the National Archives to the Secret Service is the appropriate action for them to take here?
Absolutely, because quite frankly, one of the main functions of the archives is to get access to records. Without those records, you can't hold government accountable. That's across the board, regardless of what situation we're talking about. It's just a basic fundamental fact that without those records, you can't have the full accountability. And so absolutely, I've seen the letter that went out from the archives and laid out very specifically. They're carrying out their role as the keeper of all the records with the responsibility to see and they're created, they're preserved, and made accessible.
How unusual is a request like this?
Very unusual. Very unusual. Now, I mean, I go back to 10 years working with the Nixon records, and that was a somewhat similar over a long period of time. But I can't think of any other experience where it got much attention.
Yeah.
There might be minor things that don't ever get in the press or get out of the attention of just maybe a couple people in the archives. But situation like this, not very often.
Do the archives have any way to enforce their request, or is it basically up to the Secret Service to comply?
It's up to the Secret Service. Unfortunately, in my opinion, the archives have no support or even appropriations for, I mean, they're just doing it out of their basic budget now. Mm. And all they can do is, as this letter points out very clearly, it is their responsibility. The law is very clear. All presidential records are official records, permanent records, to be made eventually available to the public, in this case, before the public gets access totally.
And if the request isn't fulfilled or ignored by the Secret Service, what kind of precedent do you think that would set for the future?
Well, it'd be a very bad one if not the Congress or the courts don't follow through and in some way make it clear. The archives have no, I don't know of anything, any action they can take. But certainly it would have to be a part of at least some of what's sent forward in the final January 6th committee work. And, you know, what the Department of Justice can do, I do not know. Yeah. But the archives have done and have followed through and carried out their responsibility. And I'm proud of him.
The previous administration obviously flouted archiving laws. The former president reportedly ripped up documents that had to be taped back together. In some cases, brought classified documents down to Mar-a-Lago. The staff used encrypted apps to communicate. Do you think that's a new standard or maybe a new low as far as archives are concerned? I mean, do you worry about other administrations in the future deciding, oh, let's just use encrypted apps like they did?
Anderson, what you've just shared has to be dealt with at some point very clearly by the government. And I'm not in a position to say, okay, who does what? But it's got to be made clear that future administrations cannot just use it as an excuse. Somebody got away with it. That's established a pattern. No, that would be incredibly damaging to our democracy and the rule of law. Be unbelievably damaging to this country if that became a pattern.
Yeah. Governor Carlin, I really appreciate your time tonight. Thank you.
You're most welcome. Thank you for covering this.
Well, coming up, news just into CNN, Uvalde District Police Chief Pete Arredondo, Shimon Procupes, has been pushing for answers as he always does. His report next, the latest on his fate. Tonight, there's new action under discussion against Uvalde School District Police Chief Pete Arredondo. As we told you last night, the new report from the Texas House Committee says this about his response to the school shooting at Robb Elementary, quote, as events unfolded, he failed to perform or to transfer to another person the role of incident commander. It took police, as you know, more than an hour to finally storm the classroom, kill the gunman. 19 students, two teachers were killed in the shooting. Last night at the school board meeting in Uvalde, a relative of a fourth grade shooting victim demanded action from the school board.
You're still standing by paying him to take a vacation, correct?
No. He is on administrative leave. We received this information yesterday. One of the things I did say when he went on administrative leave that we were going to wait for investigative information to come forward to help us in our decision-making process, and I will stick to that.
All right, well, I'll tell you this. If he's not fired by noon tomorrow, then I want your resignation and every single one of you board members, because y'all do not give a damn about our children or us. Stand with us or against us, because we ain't going nowhere.
Joining us now from Texas is CNN's Shimon Procupes. Obviously, a lot of very understandable anger is there being directed at Pete Arredondo. What new details have you learned tonight on whether or not he may be removed?
Well, that process is underway, Anderson. I'm told that by school officials that they want him terminated. They want him gone. They listened to those parents in that meeting last night. I was there, and it was incredible to watch, Anderson, because it was really the first time. You know, we've heard them sort of demand accountability, but it was really the first time where you felt that they had confidence, that they were coming together as one to ask for accountability. And that was the biggest thing that they all wanted. They wanted Pete Arredondo fired. They want him gone. And now it looks like that process is underway. School officials listening to those parents, and I'm told that they do. The school wants him terminated. So there's a process now, and that process is underway. The one thing, Anderson, is that he could resign before ultimately that decision is made final, because he's under contract. There's other things going on here. So we wait to see what happens, certainly, in the next few days.
I mean, you obviously repeatedly tried to talk to Chief Arredondo to get some very basic questions. You caught up with him back in early June. He wasn't forthcoming at all. I just want to play part of what he did say to you.
We're not going to release anything. We have people in our community being buried, sir. So right. We're going to be respectful.
I just want your reaction to the director, McGraw, saying that you were responsible for the decision to go into that room. How do you explain yourself to the parents?
We're going to be respectful to the family.
I understand yourself to the parents.
And just so you know, we're going to do that eventually, obviously.
When?
And whenever this is done, and the families quit grieving, then we'll do that, obviously.
Again, whenever the families quit grieving, and he was trying to turn it on you as though you were being disrespectful of asking these questions while people were grieving, as if there's some end to the grief. I spoke to Angel Garza last night, the stepdad of Amory Joe Garza, who was murdered. He said to anyone who says they're withholding information for the benefit of the families is lying. If someone has any information on how this happened, they want it now. And he also talked about kind of the families coming together. CNN's reached out to Arredondo's lawyer. Has there been any response?
No, there's been no response, but that's typical with Arredondo's side. Look, Arredondo has talked. He talked to the Texas Tribune where he claimed he didn't get a sense that he was the on-scene commander. But when you look at that body cam footage, Anderson, and you look at that hallway footage that was released, you can tell that, yes, there was no leadership, but there are people on the body camera footage who are saying Pete Arredondo is with the gunman. He's there. He's in charge. He's making the decisions. You hear Pete Arredondo trying to negotiate with the gunman. Some of the family members have watched that body cam footage, have watched the hallway footage. And they, watching that, you could tell that in yesterday, in their reaction to some of what they have seen, they have felt the confidence and the strength to come forward and demand accountability. And that is why they want information. That is why they need information, so that they know that something here is wrong. There was a cover up. They were not given the truth. And so they want those answers. And then it doesn't stop with Pete Arredondo. The family say they're going to go after other people who are in that hallway, and also other school officials.
Right. And as the report says, I mean, there were a lot of different agencies there, and a lot of responsibility, which we need to learn more about. Shimon Prokopez, appreciate it. Coming up, the global heat wave that has helped fuel wildfires across Europe and set record high temperatures in parts of the U.S., including Texas and Oklahoma. We've got a stunning video of what happened to one UPS driver trying to work in this environment, plus a live report from Paris on what's going on. Some newly obtained video we want to show you about this global heat wave. A UPS driver in Arizona last week was delivering packages in 108-degree weather. In the video, he seems to be having difficulty walking up to the house. He bends over to put down an envelope, then slumps to the ground. He was motionless for about 10 seconds, then fell on his back. He then got back up, rang the doorbell, walked away. The man who lived inside the home didn't see the video until much later. He called police and UPS to check on the driver's safety. In a statement to CNN, UPS says the driver later called his supervisor for assistance. More than 100 million Americans are under heat alerts. Record high temperatures in Texas and Oklahoma today. In Texas, officials say a firefighter suffered heat exhaustion battling a wildfire. The Texas A&M Forest Service says they expect the threat of fires to remain extremely high, because it says about 99% of the state is experiencing some level of drought. And as CNN's Melissa Bell reports, the extreme heat is a problem here as well as in Europe.
A fire rages through a field in Spain as homes burn. In Greater London, a house is swallowed by wildfire. These just some of the many sweeping across Europe, where temperatures have soared in a heat emergency that stretches across the globe. China's heat wave began last week, with 51 cities, including Beijing, now under the second highest heat alert level. European cities sweltered under new highs in what is the continent's second heat wave of the summer, now entering its second week. Ireland seeing its hottest day in a century. In the United Kingdom, temperatures reached 104 degrees, a first, with London's fire brigade declaring a major incident on Tuesday because of a, quote, huge surge in fires across the capital.
I think we just have to adapt, don't we? Our homes have to change, our way of life has to change, really, doesn't it?
Here in France, the temperatures reached 105 degrees. Difficult enough for Paris, which is not accustomed to such extreme temperatures. But down in the southwest of France, the impact has been far more devastating. The French president is due down by those wildfires that have been spreading for several days, under pressure from local officials who accuse him of not having done enough soon enough. Down near Bordeaux, wildfires have continued to spread, burning through still more of the parched pine forests that run all the way down to Spain. Already, tens of thousands of people have been forced to evacuate their homes in southern Europe. The extreme heat causing fires in Texas and causing the plains to swelter all the way up to the Dakotas. Temperatures as high as 110, feeling as high as 115. Experts say that climate change can no longer be ignored.
We're talking about weather events that we probably would have expected to see a decade or two down the line. But what's more striking than that, I think, is how poorly we're preparing and adapting, because we knew these temperatures were coming.
For many people across the Northern Hemisphere, this Tuesday brought those temperatures and those weather events into far sharper focus. Anderson, here in Paris, it's just started raining, a thunderstorm that's likely to prove short respite. That heat wave expected to continue into the middle of next week. And that, of course, terrible news for those many hundreds of thousands of firefighters trying to bring those fires under control, not just in Greece, Spain and Italy, countries that were accustomed to seeing them, but further north in Bordeaux and Brittany and as far north as London, parts of the world where you just couldn't have imagined anything like this a few years ago. And it is then, when people flee their homes, when houses are destroyed, then that reality of climate change really comes home, Anderson.
Yeah, well, Sibel, I appreciate it. Thank you. Stunning images. Just ahead, the politics of climate change here in the U.S. and how one Democratic senator thwarted his party's attempt to pass a bill that included efforts to fight climate change. Was Joe Manchin motivated by his financial ties to the coal industry? The answer to that question next. Pressure is building on President Biden to announce some kind of action on climate change, particularly after West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin last week told his fellow Democrats he would not support the climate provisions in a large economic package that Democrats want to pass and campaign on. That's according to sources who spoke to CNN. One of those sources said that Senator Manchin had at one point actually supported the climate provisions plus taxes to help pay for the package. Democrats need his vote in the 50-50 Senate. Manchin's obviously up for re-election in 2 years and, like his state, benefits from the energy industry. CNN's chief congressional correspondent, Romano Raju, has more on what Joe Manchin may be after.
Let me make very clear on something.
Progressives in Congress are fed up with Senator Joe Manchin.
It's hard to think of someone who has been more effective at undermining a president of his own party than Senator Manchin.
It's not fair to string people along for a year and not come to a conclusion. It's not an appropriate way to negotiate.
The 50-50 Senate sucks. So that's it.
Biden initially wanted a $3.5 trillion bill to expand the social safety net.
The agenda that's in these bills is what 81 million Americans voted for.
For months, Manchin and the president negotiated, with Manchin even secretly proposing to Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer he would only agree to a bill about half its size. After the White House came down to $1.75 trillion, Manchin derailed the effort by saying it was filled with budget gimmicks.
This is a no on this legislation.
But Schumer has been quietly in talks with Manchin on a scaled-back plan. And after believing they were close to a $350 billion climate and energy deal, along with tax hikes to pay for it, Manchin indicated he favored a narrower bill focused on prescription drug prices and healthcare subsidies.
How do you respond to the criticism from your colleagues that you strung them along for an entire year and at the end of the day you pulled the plug?
I never strung anybody along. I was the first one to raise the alarm on inflation. I'm worried about the person that can't feed their family. So I'm sorry, if they don't care about that, I do.
Manchin, who lives on a 65-foot boat while in D.C., has been criticized for his ties to the energy industry, as he has benefited from nearly $1 million in campaign donations from the oil and gas industry over the past 5 years. He has financial holdings between $1 million and $5 million in a coal business he founded. But he says that has nothing to do with his positions.
He says it's your personal ties to the coal industry, your financial ties.
You know what? Everyone has a job. Everyone has made a living or tried to make a living, provide for their family. If they want to criticize that and looking for some reason, the bottom line is inflation.
The reality, Manchin is a rare Democrat from a state that Donald Trump carried by nearly 40 points, with Manchin only winning re-election in 2018 by just 3. The former West Virginia University football player and ex-governor, Manchin won his first race in 2010 after vowing to literally shoot down his party's climate change bill.
I'll take dead aim at the cap and trade bill because it's bad for West Virginia.
Moderates say he's reining in the party's extremes and credit him for helping broker an infrastructure package and a gun violence bill that Biden signed into law.
Are you happy with the position he's taking on these issues?
I'm happy that he moderates many at times.
He's with us 70, 75, 80% of the time. Nobody agrees with everybody 100% of the time.
And as he, along with Senator Kyrsten Sinema, have refused to change filibuster rules, he has become a GOP darling.
Would you support him if he ran for re-election in 2024?
Absolutely.
How helpful has he been to Republicans in the 50-50 Senate?
I think he's been helpful to the country.
Some say he should just change parties.
You keep hearing Republicans saying he should just join our conference. What do you say to that?
We'll see you later.
There is still a strong likelihood, Anderson, that there's some legislation could get to President Biden's desk in the coming weeks, that focusing on health care issues, namely allowing Medicare the power to negotiate the prices of prescription drugs, as well as extending those expiring subsidies under the Affordable Care Act for 2 years. Democrats are using a party line procedures under the budget rules to try to pass that. But of course, they need all 50 Democrats to get on board because no Republicans plan to join them. And that means at the end of the day, they need Joe Manchin.
Mm. Manu Raju, a great report. Thank you. Appreciate it. Up next, the world's sharpest close-up of Jupiter and its moons from the new space telescope designed to see billions of light years away. Incredible images. Well, it's hot and the times feel heavy, so we want to close with something that might take a little bit of mental load off. It comes again from NASA, who last week showed the world several mind-blowing images, including a galaxy cluster billions of light years away, all from the James Webb Telescope, which has turned its focus on something much closer to planet Earth. Here it is, Jupiter, the biggest planet in our solar system, a mere 430 million miles away. To the left of Jupiter's famous great red spot, a storm big enough to swallow Earth, according to NASA. You see the shadow of Europa, one of Jupiter's orbiting moons as well. There are also these new photos giving us another view of Europa and two other moons. And in another image, you can see Jupiter's hard-to-see rings. It's proof that Webb can pick up pale objects while also capturing detail on bright, fast-moving objects, both of which will come in handy as it explores Jupiter, Mars, and Saturn. The news continues. I want to hand over to Laura Coates and CNN Tonight. Laura?
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.